Party for Justice at the Rock the Jailhouse Party, a pre-trial benefit for environmental activist Betty Croswick. The all-star lineup includes bands Fatty Fatty and the Roaches, and Mr. M and the All-Nighters, DJ Timothy Wisdom, and burlesque act Little Woo. Speakers include environmental spokesperson and former Green Party candidate Damien Kettlewell, Squamish elder and longtime activist Harriet Nahni, journalist and poet Marnie Norwich, and Betty herself. The event will be held Friday, January 26th at 8 p.m. at the Anza Club at 3 West 8th Avenue. The cost is $5 with critical mass or $10 otherwise. Come and speak out against the use of court injunctions to stifle public outcry over environmental degradation. That's this Friday, January 26th at 8 p.m. at the Anza Club for the Betty Croswick Rock the Jailhouse Party. Bob Seger from his new album, Face the Promise. We've all heard Bob's classic, Like a Rock, used to sell Chevy trucks. But now this rocker sees the light about carbon and climate change. Those big engines are killing us. This is Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. And we'll play the whole song in just a bit, along with a new one from U2 called Window in the Sky. We've also got interviews, including Andrea Reimer, just back from Al Gore's climate training session, and John Bennett of the Climate Action Network on Canada's new environment minister, John Baird. It's climate most of the way today. We have samples from two green radio shows from the United States and from Europe. EcoTalk tells us 2007 may be the hottest year ever, and from Germany we get news about the European Union's big new plan to tackle carbon emissions. Wow, what a difference from the waffling we get here at home. There's more, a feature on Greenpeace founder Bob Hunter's fears about our climate future, and a look at why no one wants to talk about the role of population in all this. Let's get busy with our first interview with a Vancouverite who is committed to spreading the word about climate change with a little help from Al Gore. Al Gore setting up a second wave of activism followed by the release of his movie An Inconvenient Truth. Andrea Reimer, the executive director of Western Wilderness Committee, or now just called the Western Committee, I believe, or Western Wilderness. You tell me, Andrea, what's it called now?
Wilderness Committee.
The Wilderness Committee, all right. And you've just returned from an Al Gore training camp. Where did you have to go for that?
I was down in Nashville in Tennessee.
And how was it arranged? How did you end up going there?
Well, the story which I only actually became aware of when I was down there was that Al Gore was doing some promotion around the time that The Inconvenient Truth came out, and he was doing a nationally televised TV interview, and he announced during the interview, when they asked him what one of the follow-ups was going to be, that he was going to train 1,000 people around North America to give the PowerPoint, which was apparently news to his staff, so they scrambled, and they're an amazing bunch of people, and they pulled together a website. The website, you had to apply online to be a presenter, and then they just sort of took it from there. It was just in time organizing.
Wow, and I hear also that the CEO of Vancouver's huge credit union, Dave Mowat of Van City, was there, and actress Cameron Diaz. Did you feel energized by the participants?
Oh yeah, it was a very overwhelming experience, but in a very positive way. Dave and Cameron were actually down about a week before I was. They did us in five waves of training.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave and Cameron were down there. There were 200 of the most amazing people that you could imagine in this room, but, I mean, some of them were amazing for their resumes or for what they've accomplished in their lives, but really the people that inspired me personally the most was the woman I was staying with was a 65-year-old woman from Texas who has never given a public presentation in her life, and she's a wildlife biologist, but not particularly active in the environmental community, and she just saw the movie and felt that she needed to do something, and this was it.
Wow, you know, that almost gives me hope against all this dire news.
Yeah, no, she's from southern Texas, not just Texas, but deep in the heart of Texas.
Almost George Bush country.
Hey, I met people who voted for Bush there. I met people who'd never voted. It was such an incredible... I personally sort of feel, as a executive director of a large environmental group, that oftentimes our biggest threat is not the one that we're fighting against, but our lack of connection with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was an
amazing feeling of connection with some really committed people.
And what happens now that the trainees are back in their home turf?
Well, so we've signed a contract, a legally binding contract, that we will give at least 10 presentations in our local communities over the next 12 months. And Dave Mowat and I, and another guy who runs Novex Courier here in town, his name's Robert Safrata. He was also down there during my presentation or my training. He and I and Dave are going to get together and look at how we can do that best between the three of us.
And did you meet and hear from Al Gore?
Oh, yeah. Al, the first day I was there, it was 7 in the morning until about 9 that night was all Al all the time.
Oh, my. Well, how's he doing?
He's unbelievable. I mean, really, in the 2000 presidential campaign, had a certain impression of him that he was, you know, relatively poor communicator, perhaps. He really blows you away. He is unbelievably intelligent and warm and engaging, and he knows a lot about a lot. And the best part is that he makes a lot of fun of himself in a very refreshing, irreverent way.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, now, the Western wilderness is better known for its forest actions than climate change. Do you think your organization will shift its focus?
Well, you know, there was a time, we're a 25-year-old organization, and for a large part of our time, we've had a belief that when you drew a line on a map and protected whatever was within those lines from any incursion from forestry or mining or oil and gas exploration, that you had a reasonably high chance of protecting the biodiversity within that region. However, there's a lot of things that have been happening over the last decade that have really changed that. So global warming is certainly the biggest of them, but toxic pollution as well is something that doesn't respect park borders or international borders. So we really have been moving over time. Our focus is still preserving biodiversity, but we need to affect change on more than just one front now.
Well, and we know climate change has wrecked the giant pine forests of the Rocky Mountains, and there's a lot of wilderness ready to burn if the climate heats up and we get more storms. So I can see a real role for forest activists in the climate fight as well. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a really, not only is global warming bad for forest biodiversity in a province like British Columbia with our vast forests, but the forests themselves actually have a very strong mitigation role to play in climate change. About 25% of global emissions come from deforestation. So even if we dealt with the cars and the energy and all of that, we also have to deal with deforestation because trees standing are storing carbon and preventing it from going up into the atmosphere.
Well, what do you see coming up for the Wilderness Committee this year? What are your major campaigns these days?
Well, we'll still be working on drawing some lines around some areas that, well, you actually drew the lines quite a while back. South Okanagan Park is a big issue for us. We'll be expanding a campaign called the Northern Rivers Campaign that looks at protecting some significant chunks on the north coast and northern interior of the province. Areas like the Elijo Valley, we're hoping, and Clackwood Sound, that we'll be able to get legislative closure on them. We also have a lot of work that we've been doing on endangered species. And then you'll see Parks Campaign and also these new campaigns, the Global Warming and the Toxic Pollution Campaign.
So how do people participate, or where do they find you on the web?
They can find us at wildernesscommittee.org. And on our very front page, you'll be able to see what we've been up to lately. We have a calendar, we have an action center, and we also have a place where you can sign up to be a volunteer with us, whether that's building trails or coming out to rallies or being in the office doing research.
We've been talking with Andrea Reimer, the Executive Director of Western Canada Wilderness Committee, or the Wilderness Committee, I guess we'll call it now. And, Andrea, thanks for sharing with Radio EcoShock. And tell me, did you get a T-shirt while you were at Al Gore's climate camp?
I did get a T-shirt.
What does it say?
It doesn't. I didn't get it signed by Al, but it says, "I am a climate project trainee."
Well, good for you. We need thousands more. Really appreciate talking with you today.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As you may have heard, each of the last couple of years is a record setter, each one hotter than the last. 2006 was the warmest yet, and now scientists are predicting that 2007 will be hotter still. We have a sample interview from a program called EcoTalk, which runs on Air America affiliates in the United States. The host is Betsy Rosenberg, and in my opinion, she's the best green woman radio host in America.
Welcome back, and perhaps very appropriate on the heels of our interview with Judith Helfand and Daniel Gold, the co-directors and producers of the movie just being debuted next week at Sundance. Everything's Cool, all about global warming, a toxic comedy, they're calling it. Comes word that 2007 could go down in the record books in terms of being, another extreme weather year. We're going to find out more about that from Mark Chandler. He's a researcher at the renowned Columbia University Center for Climate Systems Research. And we want to hear more about this report, which we don't usually get predictions on climate, at least at the beginning of the year. But then again, these are not normal times. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
So the prediction was that 2007 could well be the hottest year ever recorded. What is that based on?
Well, it's obviously based on the continuing increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Levels should go above 380 parts per million CO2 this year, which is an interesting number because it's sort of the level that things were estimated to be at around 3 million years ago, which was the last time global warming was at the level that we're seeing now.
And didn't we just have a very either warmer than usual December or maybe the hottest on record? I saw that going across my CNN screen, and I just caught part of that.
Those reports for specific locations, such mm-hmm. as for Britain and certainly for regions in the U.S. I don't know that I've seen any global reports on it yet. It takes a while to actually pull together all the statistics for all the weather stations and satellite observations, et cetera, that they use to estimate the full global warming.
Uh-huh.
Generally, predictions are made for the full year around November. So, in other words, not a forecast, but actually a postcast saying that about November is when we know whether or not, no matter what happens in December, whether the year is going to be, the warmest on record or not.
Uh-huh.
So this kind of a forecast, so far in advance, is obviously based on the increases in CO2 and other greenhouse gases that we're continuing to see. But the reason that they're feeling, I don't know, maybe a little confident in,
bullish
in themselves is because of the El Nino that is now occurring in the Pacific.
Yes, and let's talk about that El Nino effect and its relation and overlap or not to global warming, how those two intersect.
Well, I assume that your listeners, probably most of them, have heard of El Ninos before.
Yes.
And the warming of the sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific, which are the signature of an El Nino event, no matter whether we had a global warming trend going on or not, an El Nino always causes the planet to warm by an average of a half degree to a degree Celsius. And so we know El Ninos are warm years. And then you throw an El Nino on top of the global warming trend that we're now experiencing, and that's what's giving people some confidence to say that this is going to be the warmest year on record coming up. On the other hand, I have to say that we've been in the current El Nino right now in the end of 2006, and this El Nino is predicted to start waning later this spring. So how that's going to affect all of 2007 and what happens in late 2007, I don't think anybody really knows.
And speaking of spring, just last week there were reports of cherry blossoms coming out in January, and ski resorts on the East Coast really looking for the snow.
I believe that. I'm speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin right now, and it was 50 degrees today, and I was running around without a coat on, so that's not something that happens too often in Wisconsin this time of year.
So do you agree with the British climate scientist who made this prediction? Does it seem like it could very well be the hottest record year?
Yeah, I believe that this came from Jones, and that institute as well as ours are the two institutes that do the primary forecasting, or postcasting, I should say, as to whether or not the years are the warmest. So it's coming from a reputable source.
So what's the appropriate response? Should we be concerned? Should we look at our own CO2 emission output, each of us?
Yeah, I think that, again, you know, everybody has to look at their own sort of fingerprint on the planet these days. And, you know, as an example, I went out to buy a minivan with my family last year and, you know, was chagrined to find that the best minivan out there gets 25 miles per gallon.
And we need a hybrid minivan.
You'll find out with the new EPA estimates are not as good as we thought.
Right. Well, we say
I'm just saying that we need large scale government regulation to alter major industry, you know, actions that are occurring.
We need to inform people first, and that's what we say here. You need to connect the dots so we can all make choices that will bring greener products, programs, policies, and cars to America.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Mark Chandler.
We
appreciate your joining us. We're out of time, I'm afraid, but we'll check back with you as the year unfolds and see if this prediction comes true. Let's hope it doesn't. I'm speaking with Mark Chandler. He's a researcher at the Columbia University Center for Climate Systems Research. When we come back, the Natural World Museum and a burgeoning international green art scene.
That was Betsy Rosenberg with her show called EcoTalk. You can tune into all her interviews on the web at ecotalkblog.com. They have downloadable MP3 files of interviews with most of the big names and new ideas to save the planet. That's ecotalkblog.com. And this is Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You can hear us twice a week, most Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m., and our main program every Friday from 1 to 2 o'clock. As promised, here's that new Bob Seger tune from his first studio album in about a dozen years. From the album Face the Promise, here is In Between.
As soon as you can see, this
That was Bob Seger, a new convert to the threat of climate change, with a new message from his old hometown of Detroit. Gas guzzlers are no longer cool. And what is going on here in Canada? Prime Minister Stephen Harper fired Environment Minister Rona Ambrose, who embarrassed us at the recent Nairobi climate talks. The new guy is environment hitter John Baird, and the environment community is all abuzz. Why? Because Baird actually talked to a few environmentalists. What a sick world when government ministers have big corporate polluters on their speed dials, but it's news when they stoop to talking with people who have worked on these issues for years. But wait. Apparently Baird's consultation with the Greens was a last-minute near accident that didn't go much beyond introductions.
Let's talk to John Bennett, the Executive Director of the Climate Action Network. John, I understand the new Canadian Environment Minister, John Baird, met with some environment groups last week in Ottawa. Doesn't it seem radical that a Harper Tory would actually listen to people who have been warning about this issue for years?
Yes, it does. And, you know, we don't have any evidence that he actually is listening to anyone yet. The jury's still out on whether he's hearing what we have to say.
And were you at the meeting?
No, I wasn't. And it was actually, the meeting actually took place in Vancouver last Tuesday. And it just so happened that he was in town to view the damage at Stanley Park. At the same time, a number of EDs, or executive directors from several environmental groups were on their way to Bowen Island for to hold a retreat. So they and he took advantage of the fact that they were both in the same place to meet. It was basically a meet and greet kind of hi, I'm the minister. Hi, we're the environmentalists kind of a meeting. There wasn't much substantial discussion that took place. He did point out that he was new in the portfolio and needed some more time to get around all the issues.
So we can't really call this a planned strategy yet.
Well, there's clear. The only strategy we've seen so far is replace the environment minister with a different environment minister, and not necessarily change the tune. The real question is, will the conservatives realize that it wasn't the messenger that was the problem, but the message itself? If they accept that it was the message and want to change the message by doing something good, then we're all open to hearing what they have to say and willing to work with them to make it happen. But we don't have any evidence yet that the tune's changed.
Well, Stephen Harper suggested that maybe we should do something by 2052 or something like that. What do you think the Canadian government should do to help stabilize our climate?
Well, the first thing we have to do is regulate greenhouse gas emissions from industrial sources. Our industrial sources have had no regulations in place ever. What we need is to give them a cap of 6% below 1990 levels and give them an emissions trading system so that they can find the most economic ways to reduce emissions. But we have to put that cap on and make that part of doing business in Canada, is that you pay the cost of polluting.
And what about vehicle emissions?
Well, vehicle emissions, we need to have them too. They're really important, but not as important as industrial emissions. California has passed a set of regulations called the California Clean Car Act, which comes into force in 2009. 12 other states in the United States have agreed that they will put the same regulations in place in 2009, and Canada should join them. And our regulations should always be as good or better than the best regulations in North America. Right now, we have none whatsoever.
That's unbelievable. Well, Mr. Baird is not known as a progressive on other issues like women's rights. I'm wondering, is he just under pressure from the Liberals, from the new Liberal leader, or why do you think we're seeing a little bit of motion here?
Well, clearly the public has told the government that they don't want it to be told that we just throw our hands up and give up when we're faced with a tough environmental problem. And want action and want to have a different approach than what the government was providing through the administration of Ms. Ambrose. I think what we've got now is a more senior member of the government, and also he's also known as a real parliamentary bulldog, a better communicator and a better arguer. So the question is was he put there to present a better point of view, better set of regulations and policies, or is he really there to just to defend the mistakes of the past better? And the jury's still out. You know, he's doing a bit of a charm initiative right now and talking to people. and trying to sound as though he's eager, but he hasn't said anything that would suggest that there's something really of substantive changing in the way this government's approaching climate change.
And if he is going to bring out a new program, or have you heard even rumors about a new program coming out of the Conservative government?
No. We've heard rumors of some announcements in terms of environment and energy efficiency, some replacements for the programs that they've cut in the past, and in terms of renewable energy. But in terms of the real substantive thing, which is regulation, we've heard nothing.
And yet they will depend, it sounds like, with the new balance of power on the NDP to stay in power. That might be one of the scenarios anyway. And the new Democratic Party has a more progressive claim on the climate change issue. Do you see some hope there?
Well, I am confident. You know, I'm a very old activist, and you have to be an optimist to be an activist on the environment. And we have a huge opportunity, and this is where everyone listening in can really play a role. Beginning on January 30th, this special legislative committee will begin to hold hearings on what they call the Clean Air Act. We'd like to see it entirely rewritten. The NDP and the Liberals have suggested they would do just that. But in order for them to do it right, we're going to have to continue to put huge public pressure on those politicians. And I hope that in the next week or so, we'll have a new part of our website up. It'll be Adopt an MP, and we're going to urge members of the public to adopt a member of the committee and provide them with care and, most importantly, education and guidance as to how they should vote on that committee. So I hope everyone listening will tune in to check out the climateactionnetwork.ca website. Hopefully by the end of next week, we'll have this website up, and you'll be able to adopt a member of the committee of your choice and guide them through the process.
And we might actually get some action.
I think we will. We saw an astounding event in the fall. Part of what the government announced was what they call announcements through the Canada Gazette, in which they're intending to draft new regulations. And under that process, you're allowed a 60-day comment period, and over 1,200 Canadians used the Climate Action Network website to actually file their own comments. And we've had 1,200 objections to what the government was doing. And this is unprecedented. They've never had that kind of a reaction to a regulation any time in the past.
Well, I think people are spooked here in the West by the storms, and until a couple of days ago, no winter in the East. So Canadians are getting the message, even if their politicians aren't.
Oh, absolutely. And we're hearing it every day. The polls are there. But it's really critical that we keep up the pressure. We cannot let these politicians off the hook. You know, they're playing with the bait. We want to make sure that hook gets set, and we reel them in. And reeling them in, it means having them stand up to industry, because it's industry that has stopped government and stopped Canadians from living up to their obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. And it's up to Canadians now to override that undue influence of big industry.
You know, we have a once a year, November the 4th, Climate Action Day, but it seems to me we need a once a month day or some way for people to be meeting more often and learning more and doing more. Do you have ideas along that line?
Well, we really think that what you should be doing now is think political, and it's think political both in the big sense of it and the small sense. And we're urging Canadians across the country to rent a copy of An Inconvenient Truth and invite five friends over and talk about it, and then then get those five friends to agree to do that with five friends of their own. But also in the larger sense is to use your email, use your telephone, use your letter writing skills to let the politicians know that this is the time for them to act on climate change. You know, I've been doing this, been talking about climate change to politicians for 17 years now. And until recently, the answer I always got from them was, "You want me to do these really hard things when the phone never rings and I never get any emails, or I never get a letter from a constituent saying I should do something about climate change?" You know, we have to react to what the public is telling us is important today.
Thanks for talking with Radio EcoShock today. We've been speaking with John Bennett, the Executive Director for the Climate Action Network.
That's the pathetic truth. So far, Canada hasn't done a darn thing to reduce its gigantic climate emissions. Maybe we'll just wait until 2052, as Stephen Harper proposes. What a different story in Europe, where half the ski industry has been closed down due to lack of winter. Maybe those 30,000 heat deaths in 2003 made an impression on the population there. Anyway, as we hear in our second sample of Green Radio, the European Union is taking strong steps to reduce global warming gases. This clip comes from the German public broadcaster Deutsche Welle. They have an English-language weekly environment show called Living Planet, highly recommended. It's a great way to get news from the rest of the planet.
Deutsche Welle Radio, Living Planet.
Hello and welcome. I'm Irene Quayle. But first, we focus on the issue affecting all life on the planet, climate change. Climate change is at the heart of a new EU energy policy that was announced on Wednesday in Brussels. Motivated by a grim report from monitors around the world on the consequences of global warming, the European Union wants to cut its carbon dioxide emissions drastically. The plan is to curb dependence on oil and gas while promoting renewable and nuclear power. But as Mark Hallam reports, activists still feel there's plenty of work to do.
By 2020, the European Union should emit 20% less carbon dioxide than it did in 1990. That's the primary goal from Wednesday's conference on climate change in Brussels. Aside from this, the bloc also said that any developed nation should in fact aim to cut their emissions of carbon dioxide, the single biggest cause of global warming on Earth, by 30% in the same time period. The conference took place in response to a report from EU Global Monitors, who believe that climate change will cost over 4 billion euros and 11,000 lives by 2020. And that is the best-case scenario. What's likely if these changes are successful? The report's only good news is that the changes are affordable. If European nations put just 1 euro towards climate change from every 500 they have, emissions could in fact be cut by 25%, not 20. Mahi Sidridou is the head of Greenpeace's climate change department, and she feels that 20% is not enough.
We think that this is insufficient, that it is not reflecting what the science is telling us that should be done. We actually need a 30% domestic reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 if we're going to ensure that the objective that was adopted over a decade ago by the European Union, that they want to see global climate change limited to below 2 degrees Celsius of average temperature increase, is met.
The world is undeniably getting hotter. Temperatures have risen by about 0.7 degrees Celsius since 1990. All 10 of the warmest years ever recorded took place between 1994 and 2006, whilst data collection began back in 1861. Coincidence? The International Panel for Climate Change says that by the end of the century, average temperatures could rise by as much as 6 degrees Celsius. Mike Stephen of the University of Nottingham explains the significance of this figure.
6 degrees would be very serious indeed, because if you look back at the past context, the difference between the last ice age and the present day was of the same sort of order, about 5 or 6 degrees.
Stephen added that we're venturing into uncharted waters. We do know that if temperatures rise, ice will melt and sea levels will rise, but other effects are unsure. Scientists in Norway tried to work out how fast a glacier was melting there, but in November they came back to take their readings and found the equipment bobbing in the water. The glacier had retreated so fast that the ice from which they wanted to take readings was not even there anymore. Scientists agree the process is accelerating, and Stefan Zinger, WWF's Climate and Energy Unit Director, feels that political action must accelerate too.
Eventually, the industrialized countries have to cut their emissions by something like 80% by mid-century, by 2050. And the earlier we start to do more, the less the economic pain will be in later years.
Other critics have said the EU's internal target should be as high as the one set for developed nations. Another frequent complaint is that nations aren't pulling their weight. Europe criticizes US performance. In turn, the US say the Kyoto Protocol, which aims to reduce global pollution, is too kind to nations like China and India, which don't have to reduce emissions as much. Singer feels that such bickering is pointless.
If no one moves because everyone is waiting for the last Chinese fisherman to ratify Kyoto, we will end nowhere.
Ecological NGOs and the EU are both clear on how to move forward. They only argue over the speed and degree of change. More renewable energy, fewer fossil fuels, and more affordable, eco-friendly products on our shelves. These are considered the solutions. Another solution is to make electricity producers sell their ties to energy distribution. Brussels feels this will help the market become more competitive and help alternative energy suppliers to sell their power to the national grids. France and Germany were especially opposed to this idea, so the EU offered a compromise. Electricity producers can retain ownership of the grids, so long as they leave the management to an independent system operator. The EU is calling this process unbundling, and it seems to now have the blessing of the oil and gas suppliers. Nuclear power is also favoured by some in the EU, but remains a very contentious issue. The EU's report did add that shutting down reactors would make cutting emissions far harder, without actually endorsing atomic energy outright. This power source is opposed by organisations like Greenpeace and politicians like the German Environment Minister Sigmar Gabriel. Yet Professor Stephen does count it among his ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
And there are a number of ways in which power generation could be made much greener. Some of the green people will not like me saying this, but nuclear power is one of them. Another possibility is catching the carbon dioxide as it goes up the chimney, which is some quite difficult engineering there, but it's believed to be possible, and then pumping it into underground storage.
Yet the greenest option, and the one that the NGOs really favour, is increasing the use of renewable energy. For instance, wind power. The suggested measures may sound expensive and definitely require strong political commitment from all countries concerned if they're to succeed. But Wednesday's new energy policy was a step in the right direction. If other governments follow suit and the EU nations convert their own promises into results, maybe it could become more than just another idealistic political paper. Indeed, in the long run, it could help us save a lot of money and lives. Mark Hallam, Deutsche Welle Radio.
This is a download from Deutsche Welle Radio. For more information, visit our website at dw-world.de.
That was from Living Planet, the German environmental show, reporting from Europe. And you are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Keeping to our climate theme, here is something about a great Canadian Green, Robert Hunter, produced by Radio EcoShock.
Are we, the pampered driving public, really the climate Nazis of history? To his dying day, Robert Hunter thought so, and said so, in his last book, Thermageddon, Countdown to 2030. This report from Radio EcoShock. On its website, Greenpeace acknowledges that Bob Hunter, perhaps more than anyone else, invented Greenpeace. Bob's guru back in the 1970s was Marshall McLuhan. Hunter planned to change the world with media mind bombs, the images that blast past conventional thinking straight to the core of the mind. He was on the first Greenpeace voyage on a rusting fishing boat to protest American testing of nuclear weapons on the Alaskan island of Amchitka in 1971. Later, Hunter dyed the white coats of harp seal pups to destroy their commercial value and classically stood between Russian harpoons and defenseless whales. His mates at Greenpeace remember Bob Hunter as a trickster figure, someone who could demolish the most serious consequences with devastating humor. All through his journey, Hunter wrote and wrote news, articles, essays, and books which chronicled Greenpeace and the world of humans embedded in nature. He was often a working journalist with major Canadian newspapers and later with the television station City TV in Toronto. At one point, he appeared in a regular breakfast spot where, as Greenpeace says, he read the day's newspaper headlines and sputtered scandalously witty commentaries in a form of rapid-fire stand-up journalism. It was often hard to tell where the news ended and Robert Hunter began. He called himself a traitor to my profession and added, quote, "If we ignore the laws of ecology, we will continue to be guilty of crimes against the earth. We will not be judged by men for these crimes, but with the justice meted out by the earth itself. The destruction of the earth will lead inevitably to the destruction of ourselves." Robert Hunter died May 2, 2005, of prostate cancer. Before he left us, Hunter published his confession about two addictions that he realized too late. A couple of years previously, he managed to quit cigarettes. But the hardest addiction, the most dangerous of all, was his love of the automobile, his need for oil. There will be a raft of such confessions from the 60s generation, that time of innocence, when huge V8 engines and Kerouac-like trips across the continent had no consequences. Now we know the price of waste and fossil fuels. Hunter's last testament is really his 2002 book, Thermageddon, Countdown to 2030. You won't find climate Armageddon more clearly and personally described anywhere else. Writing for his small grandson, Hunter says, "The time is running out. for the natural world as we know it, as we humans have known it since the last ice age 10,000 years ago. We who consume so much oil, gas, and coal are the energy mammoths, a breed and a lifestyle on the verge of extinction. Like many environmentalists, Bob Hunter fears this generation will be labeled as unnatural criminals. Quote, "Those of us living now in the industrialized countries should be thankful that the barrier of time appears to be firmly locked. Because if they could ever break through the people of the future, they would surely come back to strangle us, the ancestors from hell, in our sleep, for having squandered the Earth's legacy in a handful of generations. The glorious fecund interglacial climate, known as the Holocene, was wrecked by uncontrolled pollution." Hunter goes on to say, "The corporations and governments that today continue to profit from the flow of oil will have been found guilty of crimes against humanity." He expects gigantic claims against the oil consumers for reparations for the damages caused to islands, coastlines, storm victims, and more. "Ours is an inescapably evil generation because we had a global communication system and all the information about the problem and continued to vote about spurious issues, doing nothing to change." He condemns especially Canadians and Americans, those frequent flyers, truckers, sport utility vehicle owners, all-terrain vehicle operators, ski-doers, sea-doers, people with leaf blowers, snow blowers, power mowers, motorcycles, outboards, inboards, everybody who adds to the greenhouse gas load. He spends a chapter to condemn himself for being part of it all, despite a lifetime of trying to save the planet. It's funny, painful, truthful. We're not ignorant, just energy gluttons in denial while the Arctic melts and species disappear. It is especially strange for Hunter's generation. They always expected that doom would be accompanied by the mushroom clouds of atomic chaos. But now it is our daily lives, our formerly innocent presumptions, that create what Hunter calls accelerated positive feedback loops. These are the converging trends, the various faces of climate change that feed upon one another. Melting permafrost and bogs in the north release still more methane into the atmosphere. Warming begets more warming until the system tilts out of control. While it may eventually stabilize in a new ice age, Hunter foresees this new century as a time of heat surges, storms, floods, droughts, and the relentless increase of deserts, those vast areas of near lifelessness currently expanding around the globe. Based on evidence from paleontologists and his experience interviewing hundreds of scientists, Hunter believes the point of no return will occur within the next 30 years. After that, 2030, there is no going back. If we can't act to radically reinvent a clean energy society, balanced with nature, there will be no point in activism a mere 25 years from now. Then it will be survive if you can. 25 years to Thermageddon. Factories are producing gas-guzzling vehicles at the rate of 1 per minute. 60 seconds for yet another infernal combustion engine. In the introduction, Hunter wonders of oil. Is it a drug? Yes. We don't mainline it, but our machines do. Is it a drug that kills? Yes, and not just individuals. It is ecocidal. Trying to explain the fast-approaching deadline for change, Hunter encounters a syndrome of denial he calls NIML, not in my lifetime. People quickly calculate whether they will still be alive by 2030, and if not, stop worrying about it. Apparently, humans have little brand loyalty to the species. All this talk about the future is just that. It doesn't reach that internal core where we live, doesn't stop the hand that pushes buttons for power, the foot that refuses to walk. Hunter is critical of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, because they are too deeply ingrained in the power system, despite the scientific trappings. They are oil humans, too, flying to conferences and driving about. They understate a case too horrifying to confront. The scientists hesitate, try to be conservative, equivocate, while the instruments and graphs go off the chart. This is no time for Pollyanna formalism, for unfounded optimism. On October 4, 2005, just 5 months after Bob Hunter died, the American Petroleum Institute ran a full-page ad in the New York Times advising Americans to save energy. In huge type, they advised checking your tires, clean your furnace filter, and slow down to improve gas mileage. We won't need environmentalists like Robert Hunter anymore. The oil companies will guide us to Thermageddon. Get more environment news and views at Radio EcoShock, ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. 24-hour green radio, free. We're going to wrap up today's show with a look at population. If you think there are just way too many humans, you are not alone. In the first year of the Christian calendar, 200 million humans wandered the planet Earth.
And now, from deep in the heart of Texas...
9 reasons why the Bible prohibits birth control.
It's the tough news from Radio EcoShock. The former news network, CNN, combines alarm and trivia. Two models with smiles the size of the screen announce planet Earth now has 6.5 billion people. Immediately, the camera veers away to show us a captive whale blowing bubbles that look just like smoke rings. These are glad tidings, an intelligent mammal in a concrete box, and a planet overloaded with suffering humans. Cut to Samantha Good with the latest exclusive on little Jennifer, who disappeared last night from a Kentucky shopping mall. 4 days later, the whole story disappeared from video space. A Google search could not find a single TV clip on our 6.5 billionth birthday. Back to the traditional invisibility which hides the human bloom. Paul Ehrlich, professor of population studies at Stanford.
From the point of view of the media, population is basically a no-no. Exactly why that is, I'm not clear, but I suspect it's a combination of pressure from the idiot left and the idiot right, both of which, for different reasons, wants to ignore the population problem.
We don't even have any good jokes about overpopulation.
How many humans does it take to screw in a light bulb?
One. And 4 billion more wishing they had a light bulb.
If you have any good jokes, please send them to grinningplanet.com. In his seminal 1968 book, The Population Bomb, Ehrlich predicted, quote, mankind will breed itself into oblivion, end quote. Major environmental groups know that sheer volume of humans are gobbling up nature's last reservoirs and say little to nothing. It's dangerous to talk about controlling the size of the herd. Who has a population control campaign? It's left to the fringes like dieoff.org and the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement at vhemt.org.
One of the three major driving forces of the destruction of our life support systems is simply the number of people. After all, 58 of the world's academies of sciences got out a statement in 1993 saying if we don't, and this includes Third World Academy, the Indian Academy, and so on, not just rich countries, saying if we don't do something about human numbers, we're essentially cooked. More than 1,500 of the world's leading scientists, including over half of the world's living Nobel laureates in science, signed a similar statement the same year called A World Scientist Warning to Humanity. So there's a big disconnect between what competent scientists think about this issue and what the general public knows about it.
Year 1000, population 275 million.
The world population has doubled since 1960, quadrupled since 1900. A Cornell University study titled, Will Limits of the Earth's Resources Control Human Numbers?, and led by David Pimentel, concluded the planet can only support 2 billion humans sustainably in a technically empowered lifestyle. 2 billion, that's the upper limit for a civilized Earth. And no, more technology cannot replace the need for a functioning biological system.
For a while was viewed in the 40s and 50s and even 60s as a cure for the population problem. The idea was we develop the entire world and then birth rates will drop and the population size will stabilize. There are about 50 things wrong with that. One is that there's no mechanism to create the stabilization and no guarantee that the birth rates would drop to a level that would balance death rates. More importantly, if the entire world developed, say, to the level of the United States, we'd need several more Earths to support it because, as you know, the United States is the great super-consuming nation. Other rich nations do the same thing. And although their birth rates are coming down, every child born in the United States or Great Britain is a much greater threat to the life support systems of the planet than a baby born, say, in Bangladesh or Amazonian Brazil, simply because kids in Bangladesh and Amazonian Brazil are very unlikely to grow up to drive Humvees and have 10,000 square foot air-conditioned homes.
Year 1500, population 450 million.
The World Health Organization estimates 3 billion people, almost half of all humans alive now, suffer from malnutrition. They eat far less than the waste food we toss in the garbage can. Millions die from famine and easily preventable childhood diseases, from malnutrition and poverty. Let's welcome another 80 million new humans this year! Fact. Every year, India produces as many new humans as the entire population of Australia. In India, 70% of those billion-plus people are under the age of 36, still breeding age.
In the 10 seconds it took to report this fact, 18 people died and 41 new babies were born.
1750, population 700 million.
Yet Paul and Ann Ehrlich have repeatedly warned us, the real ecological threat doesn't come from raw reproduction of villagers far away. Massive overconsumption by Western lifestyles makes each of us use more of nature than 25 or more simple peasants. There are too many wasteful rich people. Shopping, redecorating, fat with new SUVs, the species consumerensis sucks up the planet. And everyone wants to be just like us.
The problem with the environment isn't just how many people you have, it's how those people behave. And the more each individual consumes, the more damaging they are towards the environment. In a very poor country like Bangladesh, the average person has about 1/30th the impact on the environment as the average American. Therefore, when you add, say, 5 million people to the American population, that's the equivalent of adding something in the order of 150 million people to the population of Bangladesh. Therefore, the more you can control population size in the rich countries, the more impact you're going to have on the reducing the deterioration of the environment.
1800, population 1 billion.
If someday China has a car in every garage, or maybe two cars in some garages, American style, China would need more oil than the world currently produces.
La numero uno. Let's just look at Latin America, where a never-ending stream of young humans is cutting into the great rainforests, or miserably camped out in shanty towns with no services, no jobs, and no hope. It's a good place to use our wealth to help, but two idols block the door, one in the Vatican and one in the White House. Both believe fervently that family planning and contraception go against God's laws.
1900, population 1.6 billion.
And now, the Bible and birth control.
As soon as he was elected, President George the Younger cut off millions of dollars in support for the United Nations Population Fund. Diplomats were told to boycott UN meetings where reproductive health services for women were discussed. Then, he reinstated Ronald Reagan's so-called gag rule from the 1980s, forbidding any American funding for a wide variety of family planning groups, including Planned Parenthood. Apparently, education, birth control pills, and condoms are all the same as abortion.
9 reasons why the Bible prohibits birth control.
Bush supported oppressive Latin American laws with a minimum of 1 year in prison for women getting an abortion. Dangerous illegal abortions remain one of the leading causes of death for women in that region. They die for the Pope and the American religious right.
But this battle is going to have an end. And those of us who are on the right side are going to get a big payoff. Those of us who are on the wrong side will experience the lake of fire and gnashing of the teeth.
1950, population 2.5 billion.
President Kennedy, a Catholic, hoped to stem the tide of illegal immigrants by building up living standards in Latin America. The Bush administration's budget for 2007, instead, proposes to cut aid to that region by 28.5%. Money is needed for the Middle East wars. Bush has another plan. In January, the Army Corps of Engineers awarded a $385 million contract to a Halliburton subsidiary, Kellogg, Brown & Root, to construct detention centers in the United States to deal with, quote, an emergency influx of immigrants into the U.S. or to support the rapid development of new programs. For more on that story, see the article called Bush's Mysterious New Programs by Nat Perry, February 23, 2006, posted on www.alternet.org. Surely, millions will walk north, especially driven by ecological collapse and climate change. Each successful migrant to America works hard to become another super consumer.
1960, population 3 billion.
How many humans does it take to screw in a light bulb?
We don't know. The Bible and Quran say nothing about the light bulb situation.
In 1944, as the war ended, a small group of deer were released on St. Matthew's Island in the Bering Sea. There were 24 females and 5 males. They found abundant food with no predators and were rarely hunted by men. In his much-criticized 1977 book, Garrett Hardin wrote, by 1957, the population had swelled to 1,350 reindeer. In the summer of 1963, it reached its peak of over 6,000 and then crashed during the winter when food was at its minimum. 3 years later, there were only 42 animals, all adults, and all but one female. The future of the herd was in doubt. End quote.
1975, population 4 billion.
As they overwhelmed their island in space, they destroyed all the lichens on which reindeer depend.
1990, population 5.3 billion.
We don't know what they really believed as they stripped their resources. Their beliefs were irrelevant to biological reality.
How many humans does it take to screw in a light bulb?
None. Humans lived without light bulbs for thousands of years. We moved by the moon and the starlight or slept by night. On October 18th, 2012, at 4:36 in the afternoon, there will be 7 billion humans. Just 6 years from now, half a billion more mouths wanting everything, just like us. We can start by talking about the way overpopulation threatens us and the natural world. No coming election is complete without that debate, and candidates willing to act in the name of sanity. You have a personal broadcasting system in your computer, your printer, or your photocopier. You are an intelligent human being. If we wait for the great leaders, all apparently living thousands of years in the past, all living things will be trampled in a wave of arms and legs
in the big crush.
Paul Ehrlich quotes came from Deep Ecology 5 at newdimensions.org and an interview by Julian Darley at globalpublicmedia.com. From the plundered planet, this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Click on, tune in, find out at www.ecoshock.org. Full-time environmental radio, free.
Population 10 billion.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Next week, we'll be looking at alternative energy, and we'll talk with British author and eco-journalist Mark Linus about his new book, 6 Degrees. If you have suggestions about stories we should cover, just send us an email, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith, going out with U2 and Window in the Sky. If you love rock and roll, check out the video for this one. It's a classic remake of all the great artists apparently singing this U2 song. Check it out on YouTube, Window in the Sky by U2.
Shackles are undone, the bullets quit the gun. The heat that's in the sun will keep us when there's none.